and have yourselves a good week.
BBC News, I'm John Shea. Britain has summoned the Israeli ambassador in London to express condemnation over what it called the appalling killing of seven aid workers in Gaza, including three British nationals. Amid a chorus of international concern, the British Foreign Secretary David Cameron said Israel had to make major changes to ensure the safety of aid workers. More from our diplomatic correspondent James Landale.
It's very rare for the ambassador of an ally to be brought into the Foreign Office to be told in no uncertain terms of Britain's concern about what's going on. So the ambassador was brought in. He was met by Andrew Mitchell, who is effectively the Deputy Foreign Secretary. Mr. Mitchell, in the official readout, said that he spoke of his unequivocal condemnation of what he called the appalling killing of the seven aid workers. He called for a quick and transparent investigation and called on Israel urgently to scale up its humanitarian access.
The Israeli Prime Minister Benjamin Netanyahu has said the Israeli strike was unintended and tragic. Bassirou Diomaye Faye has been sworn in as President of Senegal to become Africa's youngest elected leader. In a brief speech after taking the presidential oath, Mr. Faye called for greater solidarity between African countries amid security crises. He also committed to work for fundamental reform to bring prosperity to the country.
I know the election results express a profound desire for systemic change. By electing me, the Senegalese people have committed themselves to building a fair Senegal, a prosperous Senegal in a progressing Africa.
The leaders of the US and China have spoken on the phone for the first time since meeting in person last November, in a conversation described by both sides as candid. According to China's state media, Xi Jinping said Beijing's stance on the self-ruled island of Taiwan was a red line issue. He urged President Biden not to make any moves towards supporting the island's independence. In return, the White House says Mr. Biden raised concern about China's support for Russia and reaffirmed Washington's continuing demands for North Korea's complete denuclearization. The governor of Turkey's biggest city, Istanbul, says 29 people have died in a fire at a block of flats. Charles Haviland reports.
The fire broke out in the middle of the day in two underground stories of a mainly residential tower block in Beşiktaş on Istanbul's European side. Those floors house a nightclub that was undergoing rebuilding works. It was in that portion of the block that so many lives were lost. It took hours for teams of firefighters to put out the blaze. Istanbul's governor, Davut Gül, said three people had been arrested and warrants were out for two others. He said an investigation involving public prosecutors would examine, among other things, the possibility of negligence during the club's renovation.
This is the latest world news from the BBC. Ukraine's allies meeting in The Hague have formally launched an online portal where Ukrainians can register claims for damage to their property during Russia's full-scale invasion. Officials are expecting as many as 10 million such requests. Anna Holligan has the details.
The initial launch focuses on damage or destruction to residential property as a result of the invasion. In future, the scheme will expand so victims can file complaints in other categories, such as the death of a close relative, injury, torture, sexual violence, or involuntary displacement. In addition, companies and the Ukrainian state will be able to submit reparations claims for critical infrastructure and business losses caused by the war. The Ukrainian Foreign Minister Dmytro Kuleba described the new procedure as the first material step towards restorative justice.
One of the parties in Italy's governing coalition has cancelled a seven-year-old accord with the United Russia Party, saying the war in Ukraine has totally changed the judgments and the political relations with Russia. Matteo Salvini, who leads the League Party and is Italy's deputy prime minister, is a long-time Putin admirer who used to wear T-shirts emblazoned with his photo, but he's been under mounting pressure over his ties with the Kremlin. The world has set a record for the number of billionaires as wealth continues to concentrate among the rich. Forbes has listed 2,781 billionaires for 2024. That's 26 more than the previous highest number. They've amassed a collective wealth of more than $14 trillion, not far off the entire GDP of China. A popular Venezuelan travel YouTuber has been released after being held in police custody since Sunday. The incident is the latest in a wave of arrests of individuals in Venezuela, which have included human rights advocates and political activists ahead of the presidential election in July. BBC News.
WORT thanks its listener sponsors and Overture Center for the Arts, presenting the Broadway show The Kite Runner, Friday, May 24th through Sunday, May 26th, in Overture's Capitol Theater. Beginning at a kite-flying tournament in Kabul, The Kite Runner spans two decades and two continents, revealing a journey of forgiveness and shows us all that we can be good again. More information and tickets are available at Overture.com.
6'6" above sea level. I grab the mic because I like to take it to another mental level. Low power frequency radio modulation. The big sound from underground. We bring the truth to places truth is never heard before.
Good afternoon, Madison. You are listening to WORT 89.9 FM. I'm your host, Ali Muldrow. It's good to be back. Happy Election Day. Happy Tuesday, y'all. I hope you've been, listening to Cowboy Carter. I hope you're staying warm on this very rainy day. Mostly, I hope that you vote. You've got time. Get out there and vote today. There's some really important stuff on your ballot. You got to vote. It's like one of those things. It's just like better for the world if you do it. Last week, the U.S. Supreme Court heard oral arguments in a case that is attempting to limit access to mifepristone. That is the medication that is used in nearly two-thirds of all abortions in the United States last year. This is the first case regarding abortion access that the court has heard since Roe was overturned in 2022. Joining me to chat about the case, the court, and abortion access at large is criminal defense attorney and sometimes host of this show, Jessa Nicholson.
Hello, how are you?
I'm good, but I left off part of your name. So you're Jessa Nicholson Getz?
Getz.
Getz? Yep. Okay.
Yep, Getz is the married name there.
All right. How's it going, Jess?
It's good. It's going. Another exciting time for the Supreme Court. So,
yeah.
It's a good rainy election day. And, I subbed in last week and talked to Jack Kelly about some of the constitutional amendments on the ballot here and throughout the rest of the year. So very good reminder to vote. And goodness knows that what we're about to talk about tells you why elections have consequences.
Elections are so incredibly important. And thank you for filling in for me. I was out for the month of March and I'm so grateful to be back. Before we really dive into the show, I just got to give a huge shout out to our producer, Jade, our engineer, John, our director of news, Shali. These folks are absolutely the best. Thank you for holding down the fort while I wasn't here. Thank you even more for holding down the fort when I am here. If you're just tuning in, you're listening to A Public Affair on WORT 89.9 FM. I'm your host, Ali Muldrow. We're talking about abortion today. And if you want to join the conversation, the number is 608-256-2001. Give us a call. Let us know about your voting experience. Join this conversation. Ask Jessa some questions about, what it means to have the Supreme Court deciding whether or not certain medications are going to be available to us in the future. Jessa, you've been following the oral arguments really closely. What should folks know about the conversation the Supreme Court is currently engaged in around limiting access to the abortion pill?
Sure. And so I guess to sort of dial back and talk about how we got in front of the Supreme Court for this case. That's sort of a twisted and thorny journey, and so I want to make sure that everyone understands this. This is not a case that started because some person took this drug, had an adverse reaction, and then tried to take steps to make sure that other people were protected from an adverse reaction to this drug. This case isn't even something that was started because doctors had to deal with legitimate adverse reactions to this drug, and it complicated or caused them, you know, to lose patients. This is a case that was brought by a number of physicians, none of whom practice medicine, in the Texas town where they incorporated their organization. But they incorporated their organization in that Texas town because that is a Texas town that is a one-judge federal district. And that one judge is someone that is ideologically very anti-choice. Everyone knows that. I think he's a raging lunatic. Those are the words that I'm going to use. Other people can use different words. So what they do is say, you know, we've signed these attestations that these doctors talk about they have a moral opposition to abortion, and they're concerned that perhaps at some point in the future, some woman might take this drug and have an adverse reaction and be brought to one of their ERs, which again are not in the place where they filed this lawsuit, and they might be confronted with the moral dilemma of having to finish an abortion that didn't properly conclude through the taking of the drug, and that would cause them moral, philosophical, and psychological harm. And you might ask yourself, and I know I'm going on, but I think you need to understand where this is starting from, right? You might ask yourself, well, isn't there already some protection built into law that allows doctors who have moral opposition to abortion to just not perform them? And the answer to that, of course, is yes. That's already a thing. So what we had here, though, was they were saying that's not good enough, because what we need to do is, because of our hypothetical concern that we might one day have to treat a patient who took this drug, you should just take the drug away from everyone in America. Despite the fact that the FDA approved this in the early 2000s and that they have subsequently on two occasions, I think 15 or 16, and then in pandemic times here, expanded the ability to access it, including sending it via mail. It's my understanding that about 60% of the abortions in the United States are performed via this method, and the mailing use really skyrocketed both during the pandemic and also post DOPS. So the district court that has our raging lunatic friend, the one judge court, he's like, yeah, let's do that. Let's sign this injunction and ban it everywhere. And the Fifth Circuit, which is a collection of howler monkeys not quite as terrifying as the Brotus wing of our Supreme Court, but not a great court from the perspective of bodily autonomy or equal rights or, you know, the things I care about, they said, well, okay, we're going to stay the injunction, but we are going to put all of these additional restrictions that date back to the early 2000s back in place. We're going to restrict these expansions that were the FDA undertook in 2015 or 16, and then during the pandemic, and we're going to essentially start that clock back to the early 2000s. Why did they do that? That's unclear to me. I don't know, Ali, if you have a better explanation of why they decided to just meddle around with those restrictions, feel free to chime in here. But I continue to be unclear about it.
I think that so much of how we have conversations about abortion, how we have conversations about reproductive rights, how we have conversations about pregnancy and menstruation is deeply stigmatized and is really misinformed. And that's one of the reasons it's exciting to get to have this conversation with you. And it's exciting to have you really lay out for our listeners, hey, this is where this started. These are the folks who are involved. This is what you need to know about the folks who are making major decisions about the kinds of medications folks will have access to in the future. I want to ask this, you know, because I've been curious about how the implications for other medications, right? Could we be engaged in this kind of argument about any other kind of medical intervention? Could we be having this conversation about Viagra or about an inhaler or about any other kind of treatment that people access to ensure their quality of life, ensure their health?
So, and again, let's be clear about this is not an action that is some direct challenge to the efficacy or safety of this drug, right? There's a whole way to do that, to challenge FDA regulations, to go through that process. The statute of limitations has long since run on approving this drug for the general public. Everyone has the ability to make those challenges in a timely manner to any drug. What you're asking, I think, is could we see a similar type of challenge to another drug when it's way outside of that regulatory process and it's being brought by doctors who are at least claiming to have some hypothetical harm placed on them? And the answer to that is it's going to depend on if the Supreme Court thinks that these doctors have standing to complain, in large part to me. I, of course, think they do not.
How likely is it, though, that the Supreme Court agrees with you, Jessa?
So, okay, look, I want to start by saying this is a wildly conservative court. This is a far-right court. These are not Ronald Reagan's appointees. This is not Sandra Day O'Connor. Do you know what I mean? So when we talk about swing voters being John Roberts and Amy Coney Barrett, we need to understand exactly how far the Overton window has really moved for our judicial system, because these are really hard line. That said, I think it's going to be 7-2 saying they don't have standing. I think we've got, you know, Tweedledee and Tweedledum in the form of sort of the senior varsity members of the Brodus wing of this court, right? Clarence Thomas and Sam Alito. And when you listen to the oral arguments, Alito is just like desperate to find a way to strike this drug down, right? He's asking questions about, well, even if there's not standing for these doctors, is there anyone there'd be standing for? Can't we find someone that could be harmed by this? He also introduces into oral arguments this question of this 1875 Comstock Act. I'm sure you've seen some coverage about that, which is basically a law that nobody has enforced for 100-plus years regarding the regulation and mailing certain things by various agencies. It's more complicated than that. But, you know, he throws that out there as a way to do this when it seems clear that the rest of his colleagues, even members of the conservative side of that, are like, well, wait a minute, where is... Usually when you bring a lawsuit, right, there is a person who's been harmed, and you can articulate who that person is and what the harm was. And I think it was Justice Kagan actually that said point blank to Aaron Hawley, who was arguing on behalf of the doctors, who is your person and where's the harm? Help explain that.
Mm.
And it did seem to me that even, you know, Amy Coney Barrett expressed some concern that the remedy was really, really expansive for what was a small group of named, you know, concerned doctors, that why do we have to take this away from everyone? Why is an injunction necessary? Why is that form of relief necessary? So do I think that we'd ever see a case like this about Viagra? No, because I don't think there are any seven doctors in America that are going to get together, form an organization to protest having to dispense Viagra at their office.
I mean, I think that we are existing in a time of like what we will do versus what we should do when it comes to these kinds of conversations. And I think it's hard to predict. It is reassuring, I have to say, Jessa, that you think that the Supreme Court will not ban, medical abortion in the United States.
I didn't say that.
Yeah. So I'm like, let's get clear about that. What do you mean? You said you think we'll have a 7-2 vote on this from our Supreme Court. What do you mean?
I don't think this case is the case where they're going to go after medical abortion. I think that they took this case. All right. So I should pause to say I am a cynic when it comes to this. I am this idealistic, true believing little criminal defense attorney who has, you know, the Sixth Amendment tattooed on her back. And I really care about all of it. And then I watched this court these people who are supposed to be, you know, just respected and revered by members of the bar. I watched them lie under oath to Congress, and I watched them take away rights that I've had my entire life. And I had to look at my 2-year-old and think, gosh, she's got, you know, Wisconsin was a trigger state. You've got less rights than I grew up with. I mean, I'll never forget the day Dobbs came down. But anyway, so I don't trust this court. But when I say I think that they took this specific case because they know what crap the standing argument is. And so here in an election year when court's popularity is at historic lows, I mean, nobody has faith in this court. I think they took an easy one to knock down so they can say, see, it's not really about abortion. We're fair. We'll, this is a win for abortion rights because we found these people didn't have standing. I think if there were a better case with better plaintiffs, we'd be talking about a different thing completely. I think this is absolutely a layup to try and assure people that this court is less right wing than they actually are.
I think that that's an interesting thing to consider in terms of, you know, it being election day, get out there and vote, y'all. And that the court will behave in a way that is specific to their political agenda, and that there is kind of the big picture and small picture to focus on right now in terms of why this case and what this case will mean for people. If the court says they do have standing, we've decided that they do, this drug is no longer available, what does that mean? What are the legal implications for that? Does that mean people who have this drug go to prison? Does that mean people who prescribe this drug go to prison? What happens if the court, you know, says we're going to ban medical abortion?
Well, so there are a lot of different ripple effects, right? So first of all, this is classified as a drug through the FDA. I don't, off the top of my head, know if it were illegalized, right, where it would fall under the Uniform Controlled Substance Act federally, or where individual states, you know, how each state's definition of a controlled substance might interplay with that. I think obviously that's going to be a source of litigation, because if the practical effect is that it becomes a controlled substance, then yeah, it's a crime to possess Schedule controlled substances.
Well, there are controlled substances that you can be prescribed, right? Like, you know, certain painkillers are a controlled substance. Adderall is a controlled substance. That doesn't mean you don't have access to that medication. It just means that medication is regulated specifically. Is that what we're talking about for this? Is that it could go from, I'm sorry, is this drug currently not a controlled substance?
Well, I'm saying I'm not exactly sure how they define it within the specific, you know what I mean? Like,
yes,
it's obviously a regulated and controlled substance. What I was thinking about, I was being a little criminal defense esoteric, and I'm going, well, is it a Schedule 1 narcotic? Is it a Schedule 2 narcotic? What would the penalties be?
Mm-hmm.
And because there are different schedules of drugs and they trigger different criminal penalties, and I just don't know. I mean, marijuana, for example, is still classified as a Schedule 1,
mm-hmm.
right? And we don't know. So that's more of what I was thinking about. But no, yes, obviously you can possess, there is a condition that facilitates you to possess controlled substances, which is that you have a valid prescription, right?
Yeah.
And so then the kind of question becomes, since it's no longer legal to use this drug in the capacity, number one, we've completely upended FDA authority, and that's going to be a disaster for the courts, because now what does any FDA approval and authority mean? You know, I mean, like, anyone, if they had standing, then your hypothetical is exactly right. Anyone who has a hypothetical moral objection to the use of a treatment, you know, I mean, think about the implications for that. If I'm a doctor and I oppose gender-affirming care, does that mean that we just get to take, you know, hormones off the market? I'm a doctor and I oppose IVF because I think that embryos are persons and that the creation of embryos that you don't intend to carry to term is, murder. Does that mean that we restrict the drugs that allow us to produce that? I mean, it changes, you know, historically, the way that we make determinations about the safety of a drug is the drug safe? Not does it hurt someone's feelings?
Mm. I think that this is such an incredibly important conversation, and I just want to invite folks to participate in it. If you are just joining us, you're listening to WORT 89.9 FM. My name's Ali Muldrow, and I'm your host. This is A Public Affair, and today we're talking to Jessa about abortion. Jessa is the founding partner of Nicholson Getz and Otis SC, and is widely regarded as one of the most skilled, sensitive criminal defense attorneys in the state of Wisconsin. We want to hear from you. We want to hear about how voting is going for you today. We want to hear your thoughts on abortion. We want to hear your thoughts on this Supreme Court case and the possible implications of this case. Jessa, when will we know where the court is going to land on this? Do you have a sense of kind of what our timeline looks like now?
Yeah, they usually release their decisions in June. So I expect, I don't recall anyone specifically applying to expedite this. I may have missed that, I want to be honest. So I'm expecting that we'll get a decision sometime in June.
Okay. I feel like that's a long time to like wait and think about whether or not we'll have rights or we'll have the healthcare that we need. Is this drug used for anything that is an abortion?
You know, I actually can't speak to that. I don't, I am familiar with it in the context of, you know, medicated abortions. I'm familiar with the expansion, you know, when it first came out, that was when I was, in high school, and they called it RU486, right? And back then it was only applicable, I think, for the first 6 or 7 weeks. It's been expanded to 10 weeks. I don't know if it has off-label uses. You know, I'm just not an expert in that area.
I'm curious if it's used in miscarriages.
You see, now I'm sitting here like, well, from personal experience, they never gave me a pill. But maybe it is, because certainly, and there was a discussion about sort of the healthcare that is provided when it comes to miscarriage services, and there was a discussion about whether or not sometimes when you're completing an abortion, a doctor would be removing a non-viable tissue collection versus something that still had some theoretical viability. I didn't find that particular part of the argument to be what the justices seemed to turn on. I was frankly more struck by the conservative members' willingness to assume that it is actually the standard of care that we make, you know, women get ultrasounds before they make a decision to take an abortion medication. I mean, that's just not the standard of care. They all assumed it was when they were talking about it. Well, it's certainly, to me, that was sort of a sad reflection of how much we've already lost, that everyone was comfortable just assuming that these restrictive, arbitrary and often impossible, you know, for example, some of these fetal heartbeat bills, there's not even an ability to measure some of what they call a fetal heartbeat at, you know, 4 weeks, 5 weeks, the sort of vibrations that they call this heartbeat. And so the fact that the court is just kind of assuming that those are standards that would be applied as a standard of care, you know, I mean, things have changed a lot in this country in the past 25 years.
Do these kinds of conversations, arguments, legal battles encourage medical negligence? Does this put doctors in a position where they are better off not helping somebody who is miscarrying, somebody who is having a difficult or complex pregnancy, somebody who's at risk of delivering a stillborn child? Does this compromise kind of our overall approach to healthcare for people who experience pregnancy?
Well, and so speaking from my personal experience, which is I've been doing work. Obviously, Wisconsin was a trigger state, the 1849 ban. Judge Slipper has subsequently struck that down at the circuit court level. It'll likely go up to SCOW, our Supreme Court. But during that time, doctors had a lot of questions about criminal prosecution, particularly because the 1849 abortion law here did have an exception for if, you know, the mother's life was in danger and how that would work. And so I can tell you that I consulted with doctors that were struggling with those issues over the past couple of years as part of the Abortion Task Force team through the National Association of Criminal Defense Lawyers and the ACLU of Wisconsin. And I can say that in my personal experience, it certainly had a chilling effect on doctors. You know, I mean, I've had more than one conversation where they've said, look, if I didn't have to think about this, I would recommend having, you know, terminating the pregnancy immediately. But I'm not sure if she's in bad enough shape.
Jesus.
So, you know, I mean, is that medical negligence? Yeah, I think it can rise to that level. But really, I think it's putting doctors in just a, you know, I mean, they took the Hippocratic Oath, first do no harm. Imagine being somebody who's devoted your entire life to helping and healing and providing medical care and watching one of your female patients get sicker and sicker and be unable to help them.
Yeah, I mean, I think that what we've seen across the nation is people talking about kind of the unintended consequences of banning abortion, of criminalizing abortion, of creating a climate and a culture in which people are afraid to help someone who is experiencing a miscarriage, where people are letting, you know, you. There was a case in Florida where a 14-year-old died giving birth to a stillborn baby. There's a case that I recently read about where a 13-year-old incest survivor was forced to give birth to their relative's child because the state wasn't sure about where they stood in terms of abortion. Some pretty risky and horrific scenarios are coming out of these decisions and these arguments. And I'm curious about what people who experience pregnancy can do to protect themselves, to ensure that they get quality care, to ensure that what informs their experience is not what is politically fashionable at this moment, but what is medically accurate. How do we get back to that? Or how do we get that in the first place if we've never had it?
Well, and so, you know, number one, I wish I had a better answer than, I guess it goes back to everybody's got to show up and vote. but, you know, I mean, for many women that live, particularly in some of these southern states where the legislatures just have a hold on the ability, you know, either through bad maps or just the entire structure where there just isn't the ability to get it on the ballot. But if you look, every single time reproductive freedom has been on the ballot in any state since the Dobbs decision came down, overwhelmingly the public has shown up and said, leave us alone. We don't want this radical imposition of, you know, handmaidenship. Leave us alone. And so I'm heartened by that. I'm heartened by the fact that we keep showing up at elections, and I think that's sadly one of the only things we can do. I myself, like I said, the day Dobbs came down, I said, okay, what skills do I have that I can offer people to express exactly how angry I am and exactly how wrong this is? And I thought, well, you know what? They can't take my law degree away from me. I know how to defend people. Let's go. I'll do that. And then somebody, you know, and so I would say, what are your skill sets? You know, are you a letter writer? Are you a grant obtainer? Can you run for office? Can you provide campaign support either financially or in the form of flyering for pro-choice candidates that are running for office? You know, are you a medical professional that can educate and help bolster the ability to carve out exceptions if you're in a state where life of the mother is a question? You know, take a look at what your own individual skill sets are and see how you can apply them to this issue.
I think for folks who identify as anti-abortion, when you say that the abortion pill does not hurt anyone, their response is that it kills babies. How do you talk about that when you have this entire group of Americans who really believe that they are against abortion to protect potential children?
So, you know, number one, I think part of the beauty of living in a pluralistic society as America is that I actually don't have to agree with your definition of when life starts, right? You don't have to agree with my religious belief about life or when it begins. I don't share the belief that life begins at conception, and I'll tell you why. I'm a person who had a lot of difficulty with fertility. I've had multiple miscarriages. My children are my biological children, but they were born via surrogacy. I was planning on having a third child via surrogacy when Dobbs came down, and my surrogate called me, and she's a close friend of ours, and said, I'm in Iowa, and, you know, I mean, they're not going to let me terminate if something goes wrong. I can't do this. And I said, yeah, I know. I knew the second I read the decision. But yet, I've still got two embryos on ice, and according to the state of Alabama recently, I now have four kids. I've got a three-year-old, a nearly two-year-old, and, you know, Romulus and Remus, my frozen embryos. And if there's a fire in my house, I feel like I'd probably save the two that I actually talk to. But I guess they're all equal. You know, Violet's been throwing tantrums lately. Maybe I'll let her go and I'll bring one of the embryos out instead. I mean, this is a ridiculous conversation. Next, who is the client? How do you interview this embryo and find out if this embryo is interested in being born into the circumstances this embryo is? What happens if the embryo splits? There are two of them and one of them has an interest in living and the other one doesn't. None of them can exist outside of the host, the mother. What if mom's incarcerated and pregnant? Have we now wrongfully incarcerated the embryo? Do they have the right to petition for habeas? How do they hire a lawyer? What language do they speak? These are ridiculous questions.
I think they are, and I also think this is such an important conversation, and I'm not a person who gets into, like, when does life begin? That's not actually a part of this conversation for me. The idea that, like, yeah, sure, you can think of a zygote as a baby if you want to. I think about this, and I think the right has done something really interesting in terms of talking about parental rights, right? Nobody is arguing that if your kid is on life support, my 13-year-old, who is, you know, one of the loves of my life, gets into a car accident, is in life support. Nobody's arguing that the government decides when to take her off of life support, right?
Right.
That would be on me as a parent. Parents make decisions about their kids' health and safety and medical reality all the time. They decide when a kid goes on chemo, if a kid goes on chemo, when a kid comes off of chemo, all sorts of things that have really major impacts on their child's health, safety, life, potential to survive. That is the reality of parenting. Why aren't we having this conversation about, do we trust parents enough to vaccinate their children? Should we mandate vaccination? Yep. Should that be a government decision? Do we trust parents enough to be the person in charge when a kid is on life support? How come we can trust moms to make those kinds of decisions for their kid's health, to pick out a doctor, to take the kid to the dentist? The government isn't stepping in to do that for parents. Why is the government interested in stepping in before a kid is born? Why are we so much more interested in the health, safety, and well-being of the unborn than we are of kids who are walking around amongst us?
Well, and just to piggyback off that, we're not entirely concerned with the health and safety of the preborn, or however we want to phrase that, because when do child support obligations start for the father? Do they start the second the child is conceived? Do they start at the first ultrasound? Can mom claim that child as a tax deduction? Does she start collecting child care credit? Does she get benefits when she's pregnant? No, absolutely not. The father in this scenario isn't going to be responsible for a single dime until that child is born. So we don't do anything, really, to protect the health and safety other than restrict the rights of the people who are carrying these fetuses, right? Second, I would say there's an entire line of cases relating largely to the religious practices of Jehovah's Witnesses, but there are other groups where, you know, blood transfusions are religiously prohibited. There are some cases where children have died because parents have declined to provide potentially life-saving medical treatment and instead opted to pray. And we've held that those cases, you know, I mean, there's an exception in Wisconsin that says if you use prayer in lieu of legitimate medical treatment, you can't be prosecuted for your child's death.
Ooh.
So why, you know, so really? Like, and again, I understand that that's somebody's religious belief that we should answer this with prayer instead of medical intervention, but why is that okay for your 13-year-old, but it's not okay for a six-week-old fetus?
I think that these are really complicated philosophical questions, and I think the conversation we're having is is tremendously important in terms of how we are letting ourselves think about this, and what we think the purpose of our government is. What do we think the Supreme Court should be doing and should be talking about? And how does this, you know, benefit us as members of this society? We've got a caller on the line, Dave. I want to welcome you to the air. You're listening to WORT 89.9 FM. I'm your host, Ali. This is A Public Affair. How's it going, Dave?
Thanks. Very good. Thanks for having me on. It's a hugely important topic, and I just wanted to sort of reiterate what you've probably already said more than once, and that is that the RU486 pill doesn't really cause an abortion. It just prevents a fertilized egg from implanting on the wall of the womb, and so it's technically not an abortion pill. And furthermore, a fertilized egg may not naturally implant. Sometimes an egg is fertilized, but it never implants and then is discarded at the next menstrual cycle. So are we going to say that every tampon should be checked for fertilized eggs? It's absurd, and so as you very well have made clear already. So that's my comment. Thanks.
I greatly appreciate you joining in on the conversation, Dave, and I appreciate you talking about kind of the reality of the medication, the reality of implantation, and what it looks like to surveil pregnancy. Right? What does it mean to add like this component of surveillance to pregnancy, miscarriage, abortion? What does that do to people? What does that mean for people's lives? I think one of the questions, Jessa, I've asked a few folks, mostly in law enforcement, is about the enforcement of these kinds of bans. Will, you know, how will law enforcement be leveraged to, you know, make sure people are not having abortions, to make sure people don't have this kind of medication? Will there be a war on the medications and treatments for abortion, similar to the war on drugs? How is this going to work? How do you operationalize this sort of ban in terms of a practice that's relevant to people's healthcare? Jessa, what do you think this turns into? What do you think it looks like to enforce a ban on this medication?
Well, I think that's really going to vary from place to place in this country. You know, this is a huge country with really varying levels of motivation to enforce something like this. If you recall, right after Dobbs, you know, here in Wisconsin, there are three counties that had abortion providers up and running, two of which, well, it was Sheboygan, Dane, and Milwaukee. And immediately both the Milwaukee district attorney and the Dane district attorney came out and said, look, we're not getting involved in conversations that a woman has with her doctor.
Yes, absolutely. They came out and they said, hey, we have discretion. We would rather arrest people for marijuana than abortion. Yep. We're going to keep doing what we've been doing. But that doesn't change the fact that all four abortion clinics in the state of Wisconsin were closed for over 400 days. Right.
No, it does not. It doesn't come anywhere close to fixing that problem.
So if you have, like, it's one thing to say, hey, we're, you know, certain police departments will get involved, certain police departments will not. However, providers universally made the decision to stop providing abortion care in Wisconsin. You saw people traveling out of state, yep, on a regular basis to obtain the health care that they needed. And it wasn't just people leaving the state to access an abortion. It was also people leaving the state because they were miscarrying and they couldn't get appropriate and timely treatment in the state of Wisconsin.
Yes.
Were we to ban this drug across the country, and you know, it, different levels of enforcement, but who do people go to get the drug, right? Because if universally, well, folks said, I don't care if the DA is going to prosecute or not, we're shutting down this clinic. What does that mean?
I think the answer is it would be way less accessible. I'm sure there would be markets for it, like black markets appear anywhere when there's a demand and a restriction by government on supply. But I think what you're talking about is, you know, as we said, the majority of abortive medicine is performed in this format. And I think we would see many more women, because look, no matter how much anti-choice individuals want to pretend that this is something they can will away, people are going to have abortions because it's a necessary part of medical care for the majority of people who can become pregnant. And that's not just because they're choosing to end a pregnancy. It is because there are people like me who miscarried and need follow-up health care and treatment about that when it was, I desperately wanted to have a baby. This had nothing to do with, you know, if a child was wanted. It has to do with my medical issues. And that's true for women everywhere, right? And so what you have here is you're going to have all sorts of women seeking the medical care they need and engaging in surgical procedures. We're going to see an uptick in DNCs. We're going to see an uptick in probably alternative or strange homeopathic efforts. You know, that this is going to, we're back to the back alley.
Yeah, I mean, that's part of my question. Is the ultimate goal of our Supreme Court at this point to make abortion an underground movement, to make it dangerous, to make it hard for people, to force, you know, young people into situations where they're, you know, self-facilitating abortion with things that are far less safe than the abortion pill?
I mean, that's certainly my concern.
And when you're listening to the oral arguments from our Supreme Court, are you hearing that concern from justices, from our court? Are folks thinking about, like, hey, before abortion was legalized, we saw people illegally pursuing abortion, and that had real consequences? Is that coming up in this conversation?
That was not a focus at all at the oral argument last Monday. There was a discussion about the reality that this will result in more women dying as a result of abortion-related care because they're going to engage in, and look, even surgical abortion is a very safe procedure comparatively, okay? I'm not trying to be an alarmist or catastrophize that. But anytime you have to undergo surgical intervention, you're at a higher risk of complication and problem than you are if you don't. And so there was a focus on the idea that this is going to take away the least invasive and safest procedures for a number of women and force them to engage in riskier healthcare treatment.
Yeah, so as folks are kind of weighing the reality and consequences on our court, is there a concern about women dying more often, about women, you know, dying trying to carry non-viable pregnancies, about people dying as they try to get abortions from less effective treatments than the abortion pill? Is that, how does that, you know, if this is about wanting to preserve life, if this is about wanting to make sure that folks have the right to their own survival, where does that factor in for the pregnant person?
Well, so far as I can tell, when you look at some of the stuff that's come out of Texas, et cetera, it doesn't. And that's my view. Again, I'm sure people might want to challenge me on that. But how can anyone say with a straight face that this is concern for the health and safety of the pregnant person? How do you ever get there when you've got people who, any rational doctor, and in fact, the Kate Cox situation in Texas, the doctor said, yep, she's there. It's medically necessary. And the court said, we don't care. We don't care that you think that.
I mean, the court said, we don't care. Is the court saying, we don't believe you? We think she will survive. We think she'll be fine. We think she should wait it out. Or is the court saying this pregnancy is a death sentence? And if she didn't want to die, she shouldn't have gotten pregnant.
They're basically saying the first thing, that we don't believe you. Because, you know, in my experience, clearly judges are in a far better position to determine where somebody's pregnancy is risk-wise than a trained OBGYN. Clearly, we want me with my art history degree making that decision over somebody with a medical degree.
Yeah, I mean, I'm curious why the courts don't believe that pregnancy can be life-threatening and that some pregnancies are not viable. We saw this case a few years ago where, you know, judges wanted to force doctors to try to re-implant atopic pregnancies. For folks who are listening and don't know, an atopic pregnancy is a pregnancy that develops outside of the uterus. It is not a viable pregnancy. It is, there's no medical intervention that saves that pregnancy. If that pregnancy is not resolved with an abortion or terminated, it will not only kill, the pregnancy will not only be not viable, but it will kill the person who is pregnant.
No, and that's exactly right. Like, and that, if you recall, there were hearings on that, and the display of ignorance about basic female anatomy and the way, you know, human reproduction works is just, I mean, it's shocking.
I mean, I think there's this argument that is coming from the right that is, if you don't want to get pregnant, you should not have sex. There's this whole abstinence-only education thing. There's this idea that pregnancy is completely preventable as long as you do not engage sexually. Can you talk about where we go with that? Where we go with like that sort of attitude towards, hey, if you don't want to risk your life and get pregnant, then you should probably not have sex, not risk becoming pregnant.
I mean, I don't understand how to respond to this argument. It's so divorced from reality that this is like, okay, again, I mentioned I have small children, right? I don't have a pool in my backyard because they're too little to know how to swim competently. And they love pools. So it doesn't matter if I would build a fence around it. It doesn't matter if I told them not to go in it. I'm not putting my kids near a pool until I'm sure that they can swim. Okay, people aren't going to stop having sex. They're never going to stop having sex. It's a function of what we do. It's part of human nature. We have sex. And I also have to tell you, I'm confused as to the internal inconsistency about that position from people who support exceptions for rape. And here's why I say that. So you support my idea or my right to be free from forced birth when a man has violated my bodily autonomy, but you don't support that under any other circumstance. Under any other circumstance, that's on me.
Well, and here's the thing about the exception for rape and incest, right? And this is, I think this is an important conversation to have with an attorney, is when you say, I want to make an exception for rape and incest, does that mean that I have to accuse somebody of sexual assault? I have to come forward and say I was sexually assaulted by this person. They have to be convicted, and then I can have an abortion.
Well,
because how long does that take?
And that's in conflict with our newly passed Victims' Rights Amendment, Marcy's Law, that says crime victims are defined as victims at the time the crime occurs and that they have the right to privacy. That's Article 1, Section 9M of the Wisconsin Constitution, hot off the presses in 2020. So how do we gel that with our victims' rights laws?
Yeah, I mean, I find these things really complicated. How do you, you know, you say, okay, for folks who have been raped, have been sexually assaulted, for folks who are experienced, but how do I prove that? Do I show up at Planned Parenthood and, you know, what? How do we
also
have that conversation?
Then haven't we solved the question of whether teenagers can or should have abortions? Because at least in the state of Wisconsin, it's a crime for you to have sex with a child under the age of 18. So aren't they automatically a crime victim and they have been sexually assaulted statutorily?
I mean, you're the lawyer. You tell me.
Our
16-year-olds, and I'm gonna be really honest right here. I grew up in Madison. I'm a person who identifies as Black. I went to school with many people in high school who were pregnant and decided to have babies. And you would be amazed at how many of those people were pregnant because of an adult, right? Were having an adult's kid at the age of 14, 15, 16, 17. I don't remember any of those people having the father of their child prosecuted for sexual assault or for, you know, having sex with a minor as an adult. So talk to me a little bit about, you know, where we're at in terms of, you know, how we enforce the idea that you cannot consent to sex until you are an adult.
So in Wisconsin, it is sexual assault of a child by statutory name if you have any type of sexual contact, so intercourse, which is defined not just as penile, but any bodily intrusion, so digital object, et cetera, or contact, which has got a long definition, you know, oral sex is included in this, and blah, 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 touching buttocks, breast. But any of that with a child 15 or younger is a very serious felony in the state of Wisconsin, absent if you're part of the underage sexual activity where it's, you know, two kids that are generally in the same age bracket. And then 16 and 17-year-olds, it is a misdemeanor, and that is not labeled as a sexual assault. It's labeled as sex with a child age 16 or older. But every time that you take a 16-year-old to a secluded place for the purpose of engaging in sex, you're committing child enticement, which is a sex offense, and it does require a sex offender registry and all of that. So we're right back to, I don't see how you can say with a straight face that anyone age 17 or younger isn't a crime victim of a sexual crime by being impregnated. And it's actually an aggravating factor if a pregnancy results for very young girls, very young children. But, you know, I mean, that, like, it's, I don't understand how you can make any argument but that when that's just the legal definition of sexual assault of a child here.
I mean, I think that there's a lot there and a lot to talk about in terms of Wisconsin and where Wisconsin exists legally right now. I think it's important while we have this conversation to make sure people know you can get an abortion in Wisconsin. What are the laws and restrictions around getting an abortion in Wisconsin? And how should folks navigate kind of the current and ever-changing political reality of abortion access right here in our state?
Yep. So as we talked about, there were three counties that had abortion providers available, Milwaukee, Dane, and Sheboygan. There was immediately a facial challenge. So what happened after Dobbs was there were actually two statutes on the books in Wisconsin that purported to deal with the concept of abortion. One was titled abortion, but is really a feticide statute. I'll get to that. And that's the 1849 so-called abortion ban. The second statute was passed in response to Roe v. Wade, and it kind of tracks sort of traditional abortion by way of fetal viability, similar to the standards set forth in Roe, right? And so what happened was immediately after Dobbs, the Department of Justice raised a challenge saying, look, we've got these two conflicting statutes. We think the new one applies, not this 1849 one. And Joel Ermansky, the elected DA and anti-choice person involved in this that has some elected official capacity, he is out of Sheboygan. He was saying, no, I'm going to prosecute under this. And so, you know, he became part of this. And this landed in front of Judge Diane Schlipper in the Dane County Circuit Court. I think it was this past summer that her trial court decision came down saying, nope, this 1849 so-called abortion ban is actually dealing with feticide. So this was actually intended to criminalize, you know, the malicious and intentional killing of a fetus, not by a doctor, by like an abusive partner or something, you know.
Mm-hmm.
And upholding the post-Roe viability statute that we find in Chapter 940. Now, that case is going to ultimately go up to the Wisconsin Supreme Court. They have not heard argument on it yet. They
well,
will.
And I just want to chime in that feticide, I think, or the malicious intent to kill a fetus, you know, by a spouse who is abusing their partner, that's not actually like a rare thing. The most common way someone will die while pregnant is homicide. They will be murdered by their partner. It is domestic violence. Domestic violence is the number one cause of homicide in Dane County. So, you know, when we're talking about this, we have to talk about the way these issues connect. I really want to get into in this last minute, what are the rules and restrictions right now? Jessa, what can you give us in 30 seconds? What should people know about getting an abortion today?
So right now in Wisconsin, you can do it, right? You can do it up to viability. You can do it through the clinics that are open and operational. We have access to medication and surgical abortions subject to the pre-dob sort of like you still have to go and do an ultrasound and come back 48 hours later or something for a follow-up to make sure that you understand what you're doing. So there are still some of those kind of anti-choice, atavistic.
Yeah, there's some of the most harsh restrictions in the country, right? You have to have a vaginal ultrasound. You have to listen to the heartbeat. Your insurance won't cover it if you have state insurance. And you have a waiting period for abortion. And still, you can get an abortion in Sheboygan. You can get one in Milwaukee. You can get one here in Madison. Jessa, I cannot thank you enough for joining us on the air today. I hope we can have you back in June to talk about the decision. Thank you. Thank you so much for everything you're doing to make sure people have accurate information about abortion. Huge shout out to my producer, Jade. I thought I could not love her any more than I already love her. And then I got to talk to you, Jessa, and I'm like, she's the best. Huge shout out to Jade.
Well, thanks for having me. This is a topic I could go on all day about. So
let's do it again. Thanks for listening to WORT, everybody.
Disregard the mainstream. Media distorted. We come and listen and support it. Live and direct, we come and never pre-recorded. With information that would never be reported. Disregard the mainstream. Media distorted. We come and...
This is Civica Radio's Letters on Politics on today's show.
So the African Blood Brotherhood was founded by people like Richard B. Moore, Cyril Briggs, Grace P. Campbell, many of whom were Caribbean in origin. And they were basically what we would now refer to as like a revolutionary Black nationalist organization. So they combined socialism with Black liberation, right? And they saw the Bolshevik Revolution as a sort of catalyst for an anti-imperial, anti-colonial kind of world proletariat.
In the early 20th century, the African Blood Brotherhood would merge with the American Communist Party, making the CPUSA perhaps the most multiracial, anti-racist political organization in the country. Today, we're going to be in conversation about this history. Our guest is Therese Burden-Stelly. She has co-edited a new book called Organize, Fight, Win, Black Communist Women's Political Writing. It is the first of its kind, and she joins us to talk about it next on Letters and Politics. But first, the news.
BBC News, I'm John Shea. Britain has summoned the Israeli ambassador in London to express condemnation over what it called the appalling killing of seven aid workers in Gaza, including three British nationals. Amid a chorus of international concern, the British Foreign Secretary, David Cameron, said Israel had to improve the safety of aid workers. Here's James Landale.
It's very rare for the ambassador of an ally to be brought into the Foreign Office, to be told in no uncertain terms of Britain's concern about what's going on. It's not just that this incident is upsetting allies, it's tarnishing Israel's reputation even further. It is undermining Israel's claim that it is allowing humanitarian aid.